Happy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this week we're doing things a little differently. Instead of being live in the studio with you taking calls, I am actually going to bring you two conversations from the road with two very different people that I hope will bring you the same sense of inspiration and hope that I felt when I met both of these gentlemen. It seems like at this time, we really need to balance the negative information that keeps coming at us day in and day out, 24/7, of all of the horrific things that keep happening around the world, in our country, in our communities, in our hometown. We need to have a balance to this information so that we don't become overwhelmed or feel frozen or feel so frightened that we can't take any steps in any direction. Because now more than ever, we need everyone to feel empowered to do what they can, whatever that can is that they do, so that we can be moving in a positive direction. Whether that's speaking up at rallies or attending rallies, whether it's writing letters, whether it's caring for children or developing a business that supports the next generation, or inspiring those who are feeling like life is over for them to continue on. We need to focus as much energy as we can on people who are making a difference in small ways in their communities and in their lives and in the world, and build on those positive stories so that we can find the inspiration and the energy to do our own part in whatever way we can. So I'm looking forward to sharing these conversations that I had, one with a 75-year-old world champion sprint triathlete, and the other with a 28-year-old entrepreneur who has already started 5 businesses and is working towards mentoring young artists who are coming up through the music scene to give them opportunities that aren't really available at this time. And so, although we won't be opening up the phone lines to take your calls, you can still participate in the conversation by finding me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Like our page, and you'll get updates every week of shows or pictures or information. And you can also leave a message there or comment on any shows to continue the conversation with other listeners. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. or listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And you can podcast the show by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR One, however you find your podcasts. Search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, and the shows will be uploaded to your device. You can listen at your convenience. And so without any further ado, I would like to introduce you to Mike Wood. I met Mike last summer when I was up at Huntington Lake with my husband. He was there for a sailing regatta, and I was passing my time exploring the beautiful woods around the lake and riding my bike on different trails. And I was riding along this trail on the outside of the lake, and I kept seeing signs that said, you know, look out for bears or be aware for bears. And I didn't think much about it. But then I had this moment when I was the farthest point away from where our campsite was. I thought, nobody really knows I'm riding my bike out here. And what would I do if I saw a bear? And I started to get a little anxious. And so I turned around on my bike and started riding back on the trail a little faster than I had ridden out. You know that sense that you get that something might be following you? I started having that feeling. And so I'm pedaling a little faster and faster. And I see coming towards me this elder gentleman running really fast. And I thought, oh no, I wonder if he's running from a bear because he's really sprinting. And so I kind of waved to him and he nicely stopped. And I said, I'm concerned. Are these trails safe? I mean, are there bears? I see signs everywhere. And he said, oh, no, you're fine. Not down in this area. You're doing well. And I said, so you were running so fast. I thought maybe you were running from something. And he said, no, I'm actually training. I'm attending the world finals of sprint triathlon and Olympic distance triathlons in Rotterdam in September. And I'm on a training run. And I was instantly interested because my first thought was, how old are you? And he said, I'm 75 years old. And I said, you do a sprint triathlon? He said, yes, I do. And I said, can we talk about how you got to becoming a sprint triathlete? And he said, absolutely. And so he joined me at my campsite when he was done with his training, and we spent an absolutely fascinating 45 minutes talking about his life growing up in Santa Cruz, surfing back in the late 40s, early 50s, before anyone really talked about surfing. And then we moved on to talking about his desire to do something with his life once he retired from teaching at the age of 58. Mike Ward had a long career teaching seventh grade students, and then he retired to raise his youngest son and found a passion for this activity that has been part of his life for the last 17 years. And so I am Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm happy to introduce you to Mike Ward. Wash away my troubles, wash away my pain, with the rain and shine by love. Wash away my sorrow, wash away my shame, with the rain. We talked about on the trail also, because you were running, not jogging, as I said, you were running. So it's 75, you're retired from teaching. How many years did you teach?
I taught 36 years.
And where did you, which school did you retire from?
That was Blackstock Junior High in Wainimi, Port Wainimi, California, and Ventura County. And I wound up, you know, I always thought I was going to be a high school teacher, I wound up really liking seventh graders, and that's a very vulnerable period in kids' lives, and I think that it's not easy being a kid, and I felt like that was a important place to be, I spent 36 years went by awfully quickly.
So tell me about seventh graders that you noticed. Like what when you talk about it's a tough time being kids who are vulnerable, what specifically did you notice? And did it change over your years of teaching?
Well, first of all, they just had a tremendous amount of energy.
Yeah.
And you had to be able to accept that and be comfortable with it and express it in a lot of different ways. And to allow them to express that energy was very important, and also it's a very self-conscious time. They're changing so quickly. They don't know what their place in the world is with other people, with their parents, with their teachers, with anyone, and just helping them to feel comfortable, to feel what you have to say is important, and all that. That mattered, at any rate, to them. And that was so long ago. You know, that was 17 years ago. It's almost like another lifetime ago.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that, you've been retired almost half of the amount of time you worked.
Wow. Yeah, I'm going to get all my quarters back from my stairs. So, that's a goal, to make sure I would like to... to enjoy this phase of my life for a good long time, and it certainly has been very valuable, and I'm loving life. You know.
So you retired at 58.
50, that's right.
Okay, I did my quick math.
Good. Yeah, you're good.
I know. I'm thinking back to my math teachers; they'd be actually surprised.
It was a little. I bet not.
Yeah, but, they would.
No, it was early, and it was a financial sacrifice to do that. But our son was just turning 12 then, and I wanted to be home, you know, and so I wound up volunteering at his school and doing a lot there through junior high and I had always thought. I remember, when the whole idea of triathlon had first come out, I thought, I could do pretty well at that. I think that would be something good. But I waited and I said, when I retire, I'm going to do that. And so I said, I'm going to get in the best shape of my life. And I did.
What year was this?
That was 2000.
Okay. So I guess when you got to your last child and he was 12, there was probably a part of you that thought, I want to be there for every minute of this.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not going to lose this this opportunity. So it was a wonderful, wonderful chance. Life is very good. You know, there's hard times and there's things that come, but life is good. And
keep saying that because I want everyone to keep hearing that mantra. Life is good. So let's talk about this wanting to get in the best shape of your life at 58. When you passed me running, you're 75 years old and your shirt had the China Peak Triathlon. So I'm assuming you competed at 75. So tell me about your life as an athlete from 58 to 75, and what are you training for? Because you said, I'm in a training run.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm always training, but I've always been active doing things, but triathlon is kind of a consuming thing.
How old were you when you did your first one?
My first one was 58, I came in eighth in my age group, and right in the middle, I think is eighth out of 15 or 16 people. But it was, I wasn't that far away from the leader. I made a whole bunch of mistakes. I did a whole just bunch of bonehead things.
And where was the first triathlon?
The first one was Hermosa Beach. Okay. My son, my oldest boy, did it with me. And so that was his first and last triathlon. and keep hoping that, we'll do one. But he's very busy he's got a lot to take care of, and including two boys of his own. But I'm still, there's this part that I would love. My oldest boy's name is Mike Wood, and his oldest boy's name is Mike Wood. And I really want to do a triathlon and have all three of us finish together and be a challenge to the announcer. Anyway,
you could even have a team, a relay team of Mike Woods.
I think we all did the whole thing together.
Hardcore, Mike. I'm sorry. that's a lot.
But I kept working at it, and my goal was to be good at it.
Was it as big a sport then, or did you have to kind of train on your own? Like, was there a lot of information on how to prepare for triathlon then?
Well, there is online. I just, went on through active.com.
But even 17 years ago?
Yes, it's been around. The triathlon has been at least 30 years. There are some people I compete with that have been doing it for over 30 years, and that's fantastic.
Yeah.
There was one guy, Bill Bell, that I raced in Redondo Beach. He was 93 at the race. His daughter had driven him there, and he was sharp as a tack. He couldn't hear very much at all, but he was really bright. Did the whole race, and then we had raced also in San Diego, and that was a tough course. I had to climb Mount Soledad on the bike, I think he was 89, almost 90 when he did that one. So there are a lot of inspirational people in the sport, and it has, it has a very rich history. It's kind of that, like outside the norm anyway.
Right. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we're not in the studio today, and so we're bringing you a show from the road. My guest today is Mike Wood, and we're talking about his life as a sprint triathlete, a world champion sprint triathlete, and what this adventure of training and competing has brought to his life at a time when people are actually slowing down and feeling like the opportunities to compete at such a high level have passed them by. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I don't know much about it, except I know I always see people post pictures of having completed triathlons, but I don't know much about the history or what would drive someone to want to do it.
Well, any time you go to a triathlon, there may be 600 people in the race, and there are 600 inspirational stories there.
So what was your first inspiration? Because you were saying, I want to be in the best shape of my life, but there's a lot of things you can do to get in good shape. Yeah. So why triathlon? Why did that call you?
I'd always done a lot of different things, but I had had swimming background, and I had swum in college and lifeguarded and coached And but I also loved the bike, and I'd always biked and all my life. And I thought, well, all I have to do is learn to run, and I'll have it. And I think that would be kind of fun. So it was just things that I did really like to do. And you know, we still kayaked, and I did taekwondo and played volleyball and basketball, and there were always a lot of activities. And then I always was swimming and doing master swimming. But I was always doing something. But that just somehow it was kind of a magical thing, and it was different. It's kind of like when I started surfing as a kid, and I remember in. Late, it must have been 1948, 49 or something. It was.
And you're surfing in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you just, the only one, or was it a scene?
There were. I was watching these big guys, mm-hmm. and they all had paddle boards and big solid redwood planks, and that was surfing then. And they'd paddle out and they'd to the edge of Cowles and off the reef there, and they come back with five or six red abs on the boards, and it just looked like a dramatic lifestyle, and I thought, oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So I went home and I kind of made a little pipo board,
what that is.
Well, it's kind of like a little body board. Mm-hmm. It was back before boogie boards were invented. It was just what you would make
and it was a wood.
So it was wooden, mm-hmm. yeah, and so I tried to learn to to ride waves with that, and then. Eventually, I got my first balsa board, and that was back when Jack O'Neill was poor and living out of the back of his Chevy panel truck, and we didn't have any wetsuits then, and we surfed 12 months a year, and so it was we were just dumb.
but pioneers.
Oh, we had it was you knew every you see somebody driving. Down Highway 1 had a board on. Oh, there goes Bill, mm-hmm. and everybody in the water was a friend and a buddy, and you'd be sitting around driftwood fires trying to get warm afterwards, and it was just you really bonded with them. It was unique, mm-hmm. And there weren't very many of us, so it was a fun activity, I'd still like to get out, but I.
Yeah, do you still go out?
My sons get me out. I think the last time I was out maybe 2 years ago with my boys, and it's fun, it's not the same experience that I had. There's a lot of people in the water, mm-hmm. and there's just. A lot of hostility, and I don't like to put myself in situations where I'd rather be where people are happy, and
yes.
and that's what I got in triathlon. Like my friend RB Kitzman that I was telling you is up there in Morro Bay, and he's my closest competition, and we love to battle each other, and nobody's happier for me than him, and nobody's happier for him than I am, and so there's a camaraderie, mm-hmm. and when you finish, everybody's real happy and everybody's talking about their race and what they did.
Because they know how much goes into being able to just complete it, right? Let alone
exactly.
Place.
And what it took to get there before yes. the race ever started, what you've gone through and the injuries that you've dealt with and the aches and pains and what you had to put off to do. And it's nice to have people who understand that and value it, mm-hmm. and value life. That they're nobody's complaining. Everybody is is, hey, wasn't that great?
Well, and I think when you do something like an extreme sport like a triathlon, and you just talked about living with aches and pains or with injuries, for a lot of people that would be unacceptable to do anything that would willingly bring injury to them. But I think when you do something that you're training so hard, that's just part of the story. It's like, well, yeah, and then I'm gonna get injured, but I get better, and then I enter the next race.
But I think
that's unique to this.
Really?
Yes, I do. Because I don't think people who play golf religiously would say, well, once I get over my golf injury, I'll go back out. I think they're playing golf because it's low impact. I don't think they're searching for pushing themselves.
Yes, I guess it is kind of a selfish thing in a way, you know, to be wrapped up, because there's nothing like your first triathlon. There's this emotional high, this feeling of just euphoria that I've never quite reached it again. You know, the first yeah. one was so special, and my son and I both felt that, you know, at the same time, and how really great this is. Yes.
But it's interesting that you talk about that high of that first time completing it. So is there a little bit of that chasing the high now that you feel?
There is. You know, I always remember it, and I always have a wonderful feeling. You know, in every race, I'm always worried. Oh, geez, you know, I sure hope I race well today. Oh, I hope everything goes well. And it always does.
Yeah.
and then afterwards, oh, I'm so glad I did that. Oh, that was really fun.
And so it goes back for you, that camaraderie and being with people who are loving life and activity as much as you do. And that inspires you, because I don't think, I mean, I might be wrong because I haven't looked at statistics, but there's a lot of 75-year-olds who feel like all of that's passed me by. And I'm too old to take that on. I mean, clearly you've never thought that thought,
no.
Or you would have, you know, you wouldn't let it happen. But it is something remarkable to be 75 and still have these goals and be, you know, seeking out this challenge. What is driving you now? What are you training for? What's your next goal?
I want to be the fastest human being on the planet over 74 years old. And in 2013, I represent the U.S. at the World Championships in London, and we had there were 45. I was 71 then, so I was in the 70 to 74 age group. And
what are these the World Championships of?
Sprint triathlon and Olympic distance triathlon, okay. It's the grand final, so all the pros are there, all the elites, and the best from. You have to be invited from your home country to, you know, participate. And so it's limited, and you know, you have to earn your way there. And there were 45 people in that my age group, the most they've ever put together. And then counting everybody 70 and up, I think there were 79 of us. So all started heat together, and that was my first time ever racing out of California, and I wanted to win, but I'd been ranked fifth in the country, and all the guys that were ahead of me, but I thought I could beat them.
Mm-hmm. And you were feeling it.
Yeah. and so I had one of those great days that it was so cool, you know. And the announcer was saying, and world champion Mike Wood, you know,
it's so exciting.
And I thought, oh man, that is so cool. You know, I never, you know, I wish my junior high PE teacher could, he'd never believe this, you know.
So are you the current reigning world champion in sprint distance triathlons?
I'm ranked first in the U.S. for the, and I've got, and you know, you have a score. Every race you have gets a score, you know, on a national scale, and I'm pretty far up there. So I don't think anybody's going to catch me on that. But you never know. You know, when you it's going to the world. There's a fast guy from South Africa, and be nice to race him.
When is the next world championship?
It's my race will be September 17th this year in Rotterdam, and so. So we'll fly out there on the 11th, and my bike goes on the 31st. And
how come it goes so early?
It's harder to transport than people, I guess. But be going, and hopefully I'll be seeing my buddy Arby Kitzman there, and he's.
Do you all know everyone who's been invited from the U.S.?
Yeah,
you're all friends, and
yes, yeah, we know each other, and some like Ray Hunt from Australia. We've raced three times now, and I always look forward to it, and he's a great guy, so you know, there's people from all over the world, and you only get to see them at these mm-hmm. these events, and they're wonderful people, and you just have a great time.
I mean, the joy on your face when you talk about it, Mike, is incredible. It emanates off you, this love and passion you have for this. I can see why you're good at it, because clearly it leaps out of you, the desire, the passion, the energy leaps out of you. It doesn't look like it's a struggle to do.
No, no, it's not. No, I'm very lucky. You know, I love to swim. I love to bike. I love to run. And I didn't always love to run, but I do now. You know, I learned that, and that's the weak part of my program. But
so when you talk about your goal is to be the fastest competitor in your age group, which is now 75 to 79.
Right.
You're talking about fastest sprint triathlon.
That's right.
Not just fastest human running, but it's in the sprint triathlon.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That's,
I just wanted to be
clear. That's
exactly
what I mean. And I should be more specific.
No, that's okay. I just want to make sure, because this is all so new and fascinating to me. So you're going to fly to Rotterdam. You're going to meet up with how many people are in your 75 to 79 age group this year?
Well, I won't know until we get there. And it'll be interesting to see what contingents. But since it's in Europe, you get a lot of Europeans coming out when it's there.
So there could be a surprise competitor that you're not aware
could
of?
Be. There could be. And that's fine. You know, and I'll do the best I can. And I will be happy with my effort. And that's just the way it goes. There's a number of people like 2 years younger than I
that are tapping on you, trying to get up into your age group.
and they're looking forward to turning 75. It's a beautiful sport. You know, I was really looking forward to my 75th birthday. You know, oh boy, now I'm 75, and so after a couple of years, then I'll be looking forward to turning 80 and all. But there's no angst over it. There's no, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
And so age for you right now is actually an advantage.
Yeah.
The older you get, the more competitive you can be.
It works out. There's some sort of competitive edge in me that mm-hmm. you know, I don't ease back. I just always go hard.
It's your temperament. So it sounds like one of the secrets to life would be surrounding yourself with people who enjoy life as much as you do. I mean, there must be something about the company we keep.
It absolutely is. I've a couple of times, you know, been to like a Super Bowl party or something with some people that I worked with or things. And all they're talking about is their operation and their this hurt and this medication. And what's good going on in your life? You know, well, what, it's depressing. And so I just don't go to those situations. And there are plenty of people that are out there enjoying life. And there are people who are just fully embracing life and loving it. And
for someone out there who's listening, who may need a little inspiration, what is something you would say to them if you ran into them on the trail? What is something you'd like to pass along?
Well, it's a beautiful world. It truly is a beautiful world. And it's a good life. And you know, you just need to look around you and look at the beauty, look at the good things, and try to learn something new every day. Plenty to learn, and you'll never learn it all. Find something new that you hadn't ever known before. Go someplace new that you've never seen. Try something new that you've never done before, and you'll feel better. Works for me.
Well, and for the man who's going to be competing to be the fastest sprint triathlon athlete 75 to 79 in Rotterdam in the next month, Mike Wood, you're an inspiration. Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been A Conversation with Mike Wood, a sprint triathlete, a world champion sprint triathlete, whom I met last year in Huntington Lake when he was out training for the World Championships in Rotterdam. And Mike did go and compete in Rotterdam, and he actually took second place. He didn't meet his ultimate goal of being world champion, but he's back at it and training for the next event. And also he mentioned Arby Kitzman, who's a friend of his who's from Morro Bay, and Arby took fifth place at the World Championships in Rotterdam. So I still smile every time I think about my conversation with Mike Wood, because as you can tell, he is a man who brings a lot of positivity to his life. He's not naive, but he chooses to look at life through this positive lens and to share that positivity with people that he meets. And my experience with him was incredibly inspiring. We continue on with our conversation, shifting gears completely to a whole nother generation and a young man that I met at the Live Oak Music Festival just a few weeks ago. I was working my way through the different booths and I kept passing this one booth name, Mortis Vivente. And so I asked the young man working there, I said, what does this mean to you, life and death? And he said, it means that we need to live while we're alive, because so many people are living as if they're already dead or are walking through life like they're dead instead of living life. And I just loved his explanation. And so I instantly bought a sweatshirt and got to talking to him about what inspired him to do this artwork, to have this booth. What was he raising money for? And he said that they were developing a nonprofit, raising funds to start a venue that would allow young and up-and-coming artists to be heard. And so we sat down for a few minutes to talk about his life and his journey from a really tough home life to being at Live Oak, sharing his vision for making music and art available to anyone who feels inspired to share what they have. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And although we're not in the studio today, you can be part of the conversation by visiting us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And now I'm happy to introduce you to Andre Giovanni from Mortis Vivente. Could you describe what you do and what inspired it?
Yeah, so it started off really simple. My friends and I were in high school. I grew up in like a rough home, so I got forced by the courts to move down here to live with my father, so I wasn't necessarily always like trying to be home. So what ended up happening is luckily I met some kids that went to a local venue called Showcase Theater in Corona, California. And I was really, really lucky to come across this place because it was an all-ages venue, which is like really rare in Southern California. And the people that ran it were really about like maintaining the community, the culture, and the lifestyle of the music scene over money. So the way that everything kind of got started is, since I didn't want to be home, I used to spend a lot of my time there. And at the venue, I met other kids that went through, you know, rough things or even rougher things than I was going through. And it kind of created a small little community of us. But this place was... just to kind of like throw us back into the nostalgia era of this venue, it was the only one that I've seen till this day that had shows Monday through Sunday that were packed out with about 120 plus people every night. And really, it's actually, to be honest, until coming to Live Oak, it's the only time I've ever experienced that, where like there was a culture of people that had gone there for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, their kids grew up going there, and it was a really solid community. Unfortunately, the city shut it down, I want to say, when I like 2006 or 7. And then what ended up happening is all those bands that worked there started going to the other venues. So the venues in Southern California got a huge influx of musicians that knew how to promote, that were trained and well-groomed by the promoters that were there, and started hitting up every other venue that was out there. Unfortunately, at that time, there was this new practice, not new, but it just became more common, called pay-to-play. It's where promoters and venues would pretty much ask artists to sign contracts to sell tickets to their events.
So they had to promote and populate their own concerts, basically?
Their own concerts, yeah. So, and then they'd be charged if they didn't. So, yeah, like, for instance, myself, when I was 15, it was about the first time I ever came across it. and my parents had to sign a contract on my behalf holding me down for about $720, which, mind you, for young musicians, it's like we've never...
$72,000.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's a lot of pressure. And if you knew, you know, the social structure of the music scene in high schools and stuff, you would know that, you know, it's small groups of 10 to 12 kids. Mm-hmm. And so just to even sell about 30, 40 tickets, you have to jump into different schools, different social groups. And at 15, 16, it's scary, you know? So, yeah, there's just a bunch of these young musicians that were getting chewed up through the system, and I've witnessed it plenty of times where, you know, kids weren't able to sell their tickets and their parents would just completely take away their instruments or sell their instruments or just discourage them from, you know, pursuing music. And to me, you know, there's no better drug or drink or party or anything I've ever experienced than just being at a show. You know, for 5 or 6 hours, especially when I was at Showcase, like, my life didn't exist. I was really caught up with my friends. I was caught up with the music in front of me. I was caught up with the community that was based around Showcase.
And were you a musician? Were you performing at Showcase and at that time, or did you just wander in as a kid?
I wandered in as a kid. I thought music was really fun to watch, but it wasn't until my first show that I witnessed there that I kind of understood that I wanted to pursue music. So throughout, I guess, my career in high school, I went from being the kid that went to the shows to performing in bands to performing with all the bands in my iPod that I could have ever dreamed of to sharing the stages at larger festivals. And then, unfortunately, right around the time I was about to start college is when that whole pay-to-play practice became completely common at every venue, no matter where you went. So my friends and I decided to kind of rebel, and we started throwing house shows because we figured, how hard is it to set up some speakers and you know, some lighting, because that's how you practice in backyards. And so we started throwing these small events where it, you know, the turnout was like 30 people, 40 people. And suddenly it was 100 people, 160 people. And then the city was like really compliant in Pomona and was just like, look, can you just move it to a facility? Can you go a little more legit? And I'm like 19 years old going,
what does that look like?
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm my freshman year of college. I don't really know what to do. But yeah, it was kind of around that whole era that I realized that this is really what I wanted to do. So I spent the past, now that I'm 28, I guess it's been almost 10 years, just positioning myself with other businesses to become what I call intelligently financially stable.
For yourself and for other people then as
exactly,
well?
Exactly, yeah. So I've built businesses that help musicians.
Okay.
And what it is like, you know, if you look at the whole spectrum of how music and entertainment works, record labels technically should be the ones guiding the musicians and providing them with resources and assets. But the more common thing that happens now, they just get put into a lot of debt. Mm-hmm. You sign a paper that says, yeah, feel free to pull a credit card on me and just charge me whatever. And then all my friends that are in massive bands now, they pretty much just tour just to remove some of that debt and make just enough to go home and pay their rent and pay their bills for a month or two, and they go right back into it. So in my eyes, that's a huge flaw. The fact that the venues charge musicians at the youngest ages up to the oldest ages to perform is a flaw. And so what I did is I got the privilege of working for Golden Voice at the Glasshouse as a talent buyer for a little bit to kind of try putting local bands in there. And one of my favorite days is we had about 5 local musicians that did about 568 tickets to the Glasshouse, which doesn't seem like too much, but for a bunch of kids that were like in high school to each draw over 100 each, in my eyes, is a massive accomplishment. The following day, there was a rapper called Tyga that performed. This was right around the time that Rack City Chick was on the radio. He drew, I think, about like 400 people.
So he didn't even match what the kids had brought in.
He didn't match, but my what's really funny is that that's how they kind of saw it. But in my head, I figured, you know, if we did this properly, those 5 would have played with the headliner and we'd have a show of over 1,000 people.
Exactly.
And that's the opportunity that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So my biggest inspiration with bringing back venues in Southern California has everything to do with that small, long story that I just told you about. But just creating a place like Showcase, but taking it a little bit further, because Showcase didn't give us, you know, the resources to print our own merchandise, which is the, you know, biggest lucrative, most like fundamental thing to touring is merchandise. They didn't have music video production. They didn't have photography. They didn't have touring vehicles. They didn't have teams to help you get on the road. So what I'm doing is I'm building a music venue that has a very low overhead. We're gonna purchase flat land and build everything ourselves and design it in a way that caters towards our demographic. My business partner and I already have a liquor license. He actually purchased a bar not too long ago specifically for our first first venue, because it's when it comes to permitting and working with the cities, it's realistically, if you don't have all your ducks lined up, you can lose up to about 6 years. So what we're doing is we're lining up all of our ducks and then being like, hey, we're just buying property, and then boom, hitting them with everything.
Yeah.
once it's you know, fleshed out. But
So are you thinking, and you're doing this in Riverside, you said, right?
That's going to be, yeah, it's going to be the first one because that's where Showcase was based out of, was Riverside County.
And so if I'm hearing you correctly, is it kind of like a mentoring facility and venue for up-and-coming artists?
Yeah, so it has a little bit to do with like my roots and what I experienced with my friends. Pretty much these venues, what they mean to me is creating guardians within the local music community to motivate, inspire, train, and educate local musicians. I think it's a little ridiculous that the entertainment industry commercialized has existed since the 40s and no one's figured out a way to make local venues work together. So to me, that's silly. And I just figured, you know, my background in entertainment is pretty good. My business partner, Dylan, and I own another company called First Degree Entertainment that's done over 300 local concerts successfully with only one at a loss.
That's
very
good.
Yeah, so our structure for marketing, promoting, growing the local scene, and putting everything together is really on point. The one thing that we struggle with, though, is that we're locked out of like the upper tier through booking agents. So there's like a whole other portion that only deals with like 800 to 1200 capacity venues. And these are the guys that aren't letting the local bands, like the five that I booked at previously, play with larger artists that could help them step up.
Right, because that idea was if you can mix up-and-coming artists with established artists, it benefits both.
Yes.
Brings in new audiences and it brings exposure.
Yeah, the other thing too is that I feel like booking agents and even some musicians kind of miss that, you know, the kids that are your fans that are attending your shows now are the ones that are going to replicate a similar genre as you, which are going to create a foundation for a fan base that'll last longer than just your career.
Right.
So by not grooming and mentoring the bands that are below them, it's creating a giant void. Like, pretty much my theory is, like, since the 90s, since Red Hot Chili Peppers, Thrice, and a lot of those bands, we don't have anyone like that now.
No.
And it's just mainly because the industry changed and agents and managers kind of only started dealing with a higher tier caliber of musicians, and everyone that was local just kind of just got left.
So one of the things you probably like about Live Oak then is that we feature big national touring bands, and then we have local bands.
Yes.
That are also getting stage time and recognition.
If I could talk about all the amazing thing you guys do, yes, it's definitely that. It's also, I got a chance to go backstage. Dawn actually was nice enough to take me back there. And showed me that you guys had a green room dedicated just for them. You guys have catering just dedicated just to them. They have so many amenities that, like, if you go into any modern venue nowadays that's, like, anywhere from 400 to 800 capacity, they don't care about that. They don't treat you nicely. The security guards, the staff, the team, everyone's very bitter, jaded. Here, it's like the whole staff has been really nice and welcoming and warm. And, yeah, just the fact that even in front of our booth right here, we have a local stage like that. And it's open mic, so we're hearing people that are, like, coming here and had no expectation of performing, just performing in front of us. I'm all about this. Again, like, music just spreads a lot of happiness. Building the infrastructure for these venues will continue to do that as well and provide, you know, like, we don't know what everyone here is going through. There's people that might be going through breakups or divorces or, you know, financial strain, but for these couple days, it doesn't really exist. So.
Yeah, we talk a lot about, and a lot of artists have talked about vibes and energy and lifting the energy of all the people that attend, and the music somehow provides kind of that foundation for lifting energy and lifting moods.
No, it definitely does. Something that I always kind of touch up on is that every genre is all talking about the same stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, I want to say since the beginning of time, we've written music about the same exact thing. It's just the cultures are separated and embrace different ones. Like, what Live Oak does is it has such a nice diverse variety that you're kind of able to relate to at least one or two or three of them. And if not that, at least the people will definitely get you, like, super energized and just really positive. Yeah, this whole thing's been really great.
So you mentioned when I first started talking to you that you have a lot of pride, or your family has a lot of pride in all that you're accomplishing by setting up these businesses and mentoring young artists and creating this venue, because you've done some extraordinary things to represent your family, haven't you?
yeah, I started my first t-shirt printing business, like, fully registered with the city when I was 16 years old. I got really lucky in high school. A government teacher talked about taxes, you know, during a time where none of us really had jobs, except I did, because my parents cut me off at a fairly young age. So he was like, yeah, if you do everything right and you learn accounting, you'd never really have to pay taxes when you start up businesses. And I was like, I just started one. How do I not do that? And yeah, he's actually the one that helped me tie in my creativity with the business aspect. And that's why I went to Cal State Fullerton and got a BA in business. So I'm the first one in my family, like, first generation Mexican to do that. And then I have a total
huge.
Of, yeah,
I'm the, be proud.
Yeah, I was the first one to, like, purchase my own car and, like, you know, start my own businesses. I have a total of five now. All that, like I said, work within the music entertainment industry, and like the venues that we're building are going to be the home where you can perform there, you can attend there, you can print your band's merchandise there, you can take your promo photos before you go on tour, you can take one of our lovely sprinters on the road and travel up and down the coast, and you'll be dealing with a team of people that are all going to be trained by myself that treat musicians exactly the same, with the exact same standards, with the exact same, just everything. The first Starbucks-esque style venue that we could possibly produce in the next 5 years, so... The whole West Coast is what I want. I want the whole West Coast to have venues that all work together.
So if there are young people who are listening, or even older people who have a dream of being able to take their music someplace and perform, can they contact you? How do people find you to get started?
Yeah, so I'm documenting the whole journey through our Instagram under Mortus Viventi. So it's just MORTUSVIVENTI. So it's really easy to get a hold of me through that. I run the social media on that. I'm always going to be running it. Even if I hire somebody else to take it over, I'll always be checking it. So it's easy to get a hold of me or through the website. But yeah, if people want to get involved, or if they just want to come out and hang out, or even just come out to one of the festivals, like we're doing Warped Tour next weekend. So that'll be really fun. It's just, yeah, just feel free. If you see anybody wearing our shirts, give them a hug.
Yes.
Know that they're supporting a really good cause. And yeah, just keep a lookout.
And tell people that how you chose the name of your business. What does it mean?
Yeah, so Mortus Viventi started off really simple. My friends and I like to play this game called Nazi Zombies on Call of Duty growing up. It's just, you know what it was? It was a really positive way for us to just hang out after school and do something that we all really genuinely love doing. At the time, I was working at a small tech firm, and I was a little bit in a higher position that I should have been, and I just kind of noticed that my peers weren't necessarily happy. In fact, I really failed to find a lot of people that were happy working at that tech firm, from different deviations of life, different ages, different everything. And every time I talked to them, they were just kind of like, you know, I wish I was doing this, I wish I was doing that. And so that's kind of where Mortus Viventi came around, is I kind of looked at them all as like zombies. I was like, you guys are just kind of waking up every day doing the same routine, but the reason you're unhappy is because you're not doing what makes you happy. So in Latin, everything's kind of backwards. So Viventi and Mortus would be life and death. So every day we kind of treat it as if it is life and death, and we come and we do everything that makes us happy. So I've spent like the last 4 years lining up my ducks so that I can go out and spread awareness of what I'm doing, and you know, build these venues and get these things going. And if I can do it, I feel like everyone else has it in them to do the same, because I'm not anything special.
You're an ordinary person who's doing extraordinary things, and I think that's really what makes a difference in life, is that if everyone found their extraordinary, we'd be a much different society.
Yes, I completely agree. I think that kids in high school need to spend time figuring out what makes them happy, and then being intelligent and finding out ways to do that strategically where they're financially stable.
And to have mentors like yourself, and that you had your government teacher, it's so important for the generations to interact with each other. Yeah. So that mentors can help bring the next generation up.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the age gap needs to disappear. I've had conversations here with 10-year-old kids that were awesome, and people that could have been my grandparents that were just as awesome, and all sorts of information was just exchanged. Like even this weekend, I learned that like young children like our stuff. And I was over here thinking our stuff was kind of a little scary for them. And then, you know, we have adults that have come up and shared really beautiful stories about, you know, different interpretations they got from the artwork. And just all of it is just, it's a treat. Because I already knew our demographic was like in the early 20s. So just coming here and experiencing that just, yeah, blew my mind.
Awesome. Andre, Giovanni, thank you so much for your time. If you're just tuning in, you've been listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and my guest, Andre Giovanni, founder of Mortus Viventi, out doing his best to make art accessible for anyone who is excited about sharing their gifts. And I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and as we wrap up today's show, and I just keep reflecting on all of these conversations that we have week after week, and the stories of people's lives and how they're doing the best they can given the resources that they have, or the temperament that they have, or the opportunities that they have to share their gifts or to develop their gifts or to actually interact with people in a meaningful way. And it may start to sound like a broken record on my part, but I really feel strongly that we have to keep looking towards those positive inspirations in our day-to-day lives, because it's easy to get sucked into the negativity of the news and into the energy that surrounds all of the horrific things that continue to happen around the world, in our country, in our state, in our communities, and to feel so overwhelmed that we become frozen and unable to move forward. And unless we really make an effort to counter that negative energy in our lives, we're going to all find ourselves struggling with our mental health and well-being. And so the challenge for this summer, this challenge for us individually and as a community, is to take the time to take a few breaths every day and to tap into a story that is enriching, that is positive, that makes us feel good about being alive. Because it's not going to come to us easily. The news isn't going to pass us happy news easily. We're not going to read about it easily. We're going to have to make an effort as individuals to seek out positivity, to seek out those things that make us feel good, so that we in turn have the energy to give out that good positive energy to the people that we meet. And so I encourage you to start conversations. Knock on the door of a neighbor and introduce yourself, to think about something every day that you can do that lifts your spirits or puts a smile on your face and makes the world feel a little better and a little more hopeful, if even for just a few minutes. Because if I've learned anything over the 20 plus years I've spent in the helping professions, the thing I know works the best in helping people to overcome mental health challenges is to help them to rewrite the story of their life, to help them rework the story of their life, to talk about who they are and the things they've accomplished or the things they regret or the sadnesses they've had or the positive things they've had, to help them tell their story and then to look back at that story and retell it in a way that's more positive, that's more hopeful, that's more of strength and not about challenges. That we all have the ability to retell our story in a way that makes us feel more positive, that makes us feel like life is worth living. And that may not be enough to simply melt away anxiety and depression. That we're realists. We understand that life is full of ups and downs. We understand that life is full of trauma and grief and sadness. We get that. We've all experienced that. But the part that we tend to fall down on is that we expect life to just get better over time, that just by merely living through challenges, we'll start to feel better. And it doesn't work that way. That unfortunately, it's easier to stay in the negative than it is to be in the positive. And so to make changes in our life, we have to actively go after the positive feelings and incorporate them into our day-to-day and to keep telling ourselves that story. Even something that seems as corny in 1980s as positive affirmations, they work. And yet we forget to do those things. We forget to lean on those skills that actually can bring our life a little more joy because they take some effort. But if you can make a little bit of effort every day to do something that makes you feel encouraged, your life will slowly improve. Doesn't mean you won't have bad days. It doesn't mean that horrible things won't happen. It doesn't mean that you won't continue to wake up day after day and feel like things are slipping away from us. But you can have moments that you feel like things are okay enough that you can go on, that you can experience a lovely meal or a night out with friends or a wonderful walk on the beach, that you can find those things that still give you hope, that still give you pleasure, and there'll be just enough of that good feeling inside of you to counter some of the overwhelming negativity, sadness, anger, rage that many people are experiencing today. And so I appreciate you being a part of this conversation. As always, you can leave me a message on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR One or however you find your podcast. Hit subscribe and A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist will be uploaded to your device. And so I appreciate you spending this hour with me. And I look forward to coming back next week and starting another conversation. And I look forward to your insights and your perspectives and your thoughts. As always, thank you for supporting this program and Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Some people say life's like a merry-go-round. I think it's more like a Ferris wheel. Cause sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down, sometimes you just don't know.
can't stop. Stop the hands of time.